Back in early 2014, McKay Coppins, a writer for BuzzFeed, wrote an article about then-presidential candidate Donald Trump.
He was very upset by this profile. Not only did he rage tweet about me for days, and he got me blacklisted from events that he was speaking at. He at one point planted a story in Breitbart, the right-wing website, claiming falsely, I will add for the record, that I had sexually harassed women at his resort while I was there.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, McKay Coppins, a senior writer for the BuzzFeed News Politics team and a Mormon and BYU graduate, talks about his experiences covering Donald Trump's campaign. That's coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we are broadcasting a talk given recently by McKay Coppins, a senior writer for the online news website BuzzFeed. He spent much of the past couple years covering Donald Trump's presidential campaign. In 2015, Coppins published The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. In 2012, Coppins was one of Forbes magazine's 30 Under 30 media pundits and listed, along with three other young BuzzFeed news journalists, as one of Politico's 10 breakout reporters of 2012. He is a regular contributor to CNN and MSNBC. Coppins is a graduate of Brigham Young University, and he's also a Mormon, and he's written quite a bit about his faith. His talk was recorded last week on November 22, 2016, and Coppins was introduced by Quinn Monson, the Associate Professor of Political Science at Brigham Young University.
Thank you. Let me tell you a little bit about McKay Coppins. He's a senior political writer for BuzzFeed News, and he graduated from Brigham Young University with a degree in journalism. As a student, he turned a successful internship, of which many of you are interested in, into a full-time job offer at Newsweek, and spent nearly 2 years covering politics and religion for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. He joined BuzzFeed to cover the 2012 presidential campaign, and in addition to writing about the presidential campaign, he also became an important source of insider knowledge about Mitt Romney's Mormon faith. On the campaign trail in 2012, he earned the title of the Mormon Wikipedia from his fellow journalists for his keen insight about the intersection between Mormonism and politics. In one prominent example from 2012, he wrote an article titled A Brief Guide to Mormon Underwear that successfully walked the fine line between frankness, accuracy, brevity, and religious sensitivity. In my own circle of political friends, he's known as the Mormon Whisperer. In February 2014, Coppins penned a now famous or perhaps infamous article for BuzzFeed titled 36 Hours on the Fake Campaign Trail with Donald Trump, in which he called out Trump for repeatedly threatening over the course of 25 years to run for public office as part of a long con designed to generate free publicity for the Trump brand. The article led Coppins to become embroiled in a public Twitter feud with Donald Trump. Currently, he has Coppins has nearly 85,000 Twitter followers as a result of that and many other things, I'm sure. Just for fun, let me read you just a little snippet from that article. I thought this would be especially fun now. Maybe painful for some of you. Here it is. If history is any judge, Trump is about as likely to run for president in his lifetime as he is to accept a follicular defeat. So why is a man who is worth billions of dollars and is watched by millions of television viewers every week so obsessed with stringing along the unglamorous world of insider politics? For a person who has carefully cultivated an image of cartoonish gravitas, his constant courting of the political press seems grindingly small. Picking fights with pasty, underpaid reporters, feeding sound bites to niche right-wing political websites, trekking up to frozen New Hampshire in January on the off chance that his antics will flash across a dayside cable news chyron for a few seconds. Why bother? Well, why bother indeed, right? To be fair to McKay, here's a line from the same story where he nails it. listen to this. In context, this will make a lot of sense. Quote, I asked Trump if he has ever heard the word trolling, and at his request, I define it for him. He mulls it over for a second and then confesses, I do love provoking people. There's truth to that. I love competition, and sometimes competition is provoking people. I don't mind provoking people, especially when they're the right kind of people. Wow. Right? Here's another line from that same article that McKay gets right. Again, I'm quoting, among the chorus of yes, Mr. Trump, and you are great, Mr. Trumps, that tumble out of his yes man at even the faintest prompt, the Donald can still hear the din of guffaws coming from a political class that long ago stopped taking him seriously, and it's driving him crazy. Well, in 2015, McKay Coppins published The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. This book is essential reading for those of us attempting to understand exactly what happened within the Republican Party that led to Donald Trump's nomination. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming McKay Coppins.
Thank you for that illustrious introduction. I appreciate it. It's great to be here. First, I have to apologize. I have a cough, not to kick this off with a conspiracy theory, but I'm recovering from a cold that I think Donald Trump gave me on purpose. I'll talk more about that later. I wanted to start, I will promise not to talk for too long, I want to take your questions, but I want to start by going back to election night in 2012. I covered the Romney campaign, as Quinn mentioned, all that year, and that night he had an election night party at a ballroom in Boston. And as the election returns came in and it became clear that Mitt Romney was going to lose, the scene there became pretty sad. There were a lot of kind of half-drunk, depressed Romney supporters wandering around, cursing the political climate that had led to their candidate's defeat. And I remember there was a Romney advisor, a Romney aide, who came over to me at one point and she said, this was a good ticket. If they can't win, who can? Well, we have the answer, apparently. But how did we get to this point? It's a question that I think will motivate hundreds of books and PhD theses for years to come. I want to basically break off one sliver of it and tell you about my personal experience with Mr. Trump. Before I get too much further, I should make a disclosure here that while I think that I am capable as a reporter of providing an unbiased and fair and objective portrait of Donald Trump, he does not feel the same way. After I published that 2014 profile, he called me on Twitter a slime bag, a scumbag, important distinction there, a dishonest reporter with no credibility, and true garbage. So that's how Donald Trump feels about me. As it turns out, that's how he feels about most of the press. Let me just talk a little about how I got to know Donald Trump. Early in 2014, I arranged to interview him after a speech that he was giving in New Hampshire, in Manchester. As I wrote in the piece, I realized that Trump, for 25 years, had been very publicly flirting with running for president. It was kind of his go-to publicity stunt whenever he had something to promote, whether it was his first book, The Art of the Deal, that came out in 1987, and that was the first time that he kind of floated the idea of running for president, or more recently in 2011 when he wanted to increase Mae Sweep's ratings for The Celebrity Apprentice. What fascinated me about him was that this is a guy who's a billionaire. He has all the money he could possibly want. He is as famous as he could possibly want, I thought. What was it that made him continually come back to this well of politics? Why did he keep publicly flirting with this? What was it that made him, that drove him to this? excuse me. So I arranged to interview him. I went up to New Hampshire. He gave a speech. My very first kind of memory of being up close with Donald Trump was sitting crammed in between two of his aides in an SUV while Trump was sitting in the passenger seat, his head being about a foot and a half away from me. And I remember just examining his hair to try to figure out if it was real or not. And for the record, and if Mr. Trump ever hears this, it is real as far as I can tell, although it's very interestingly molded. I can tell you more about that afterward if you want. But we were on the drive to the airport. I was supposed to interview him on the flight back to New York, where we both lived, and I was going to interview him on his plane. He loves showing off his plane to reporters. And right as we were driving to the airport, he got a call, or one of his aides got a call from their pilot, who said that there had been a blizzard in New York City. And LaGuardia Airport was shut down, and there was no way that we were going to be able to land there. And so Trump started to kind of reshuffle his schedule, figure out what he was going to do. And at the last minute, as we were pulling up to the airport, he said, you know what? Let's just skip New York. We'll go down to Palm Beach instead. He has this big beachside compound down there, Mar-a-Lago. And it was funny because we got out of the car, and one of his aides who was traveling with us was like, you know, we still have this reporter here. And Trump was like, bring him along. So I spent 2 days at Donald Trump's house in Palm Beach, inadvertently. And actually, as it turned out, I was kind of stuck there because I couldn't book a flight back to New York for a couple days. So it was a surreal experience. I interviewed him, of course. I had lunch with him. He gave me a tour of the grounds. At one point, I was kind of free to just wander around by myself, and I just kept bumping into Donald Trump. Like, I'd like turn a corner and he'd be like, oh, there he is again. So it was a strange experience. But just two distinct memories from that experience. One, when we were on the plane, he has an apartment on his plane in the kind of the middle of it, and he has a flat screen TV in the apartment that's attached to another flat screen TV that is facing outward for the passengers who are on the flight. There were only like five or six of us on this plane, and while he flipped the channels in his little room, it was also changing the channels on the TV that we were looking at. And I noticed that he was just flipping from Fox News to CNN to MSNBC back and forth and back and forth for like 20 or 30 minutes. And I finally asked one of his aides, I was like, what is he doing? And he said, oh, Donald, he's probably looking for coverage of the speech that he just gave. And there was no coverage. And finally, he gave up and went to sleep. But he was very upset about that. And that ended up being kind of an interesting precursor to this campaign that we've just all lived through. Another moment when we, shortly after we got to Mar-a-Lago, he had set out a buffet at the next to the pool, and we were eating, and at one point he gestured for me to come over, and he like leaned in very quietly, and he said, you know, there are a lot of good-looking women here. And I was like, okay. And then he just said, just so you know, in case you're interested. And then he walked away. So that was kind of the tone of the whole visit. Eventually I got home, I wrote a piece, 6,000 word profile, that Quinn very graciously read from elaborately. And the gist of it was that basically he was, he was using these political flirtations as a vehicle for publicity, and that we needed to stop taking him seriously until he finally actually anteed up and ran. Right? He was very upset by this profile. Not only did he rage tweet about me for days, and he got me blacklisted from events that he was speaking at. He at one point planted a story in Breitbart, the right-wing website, claiming falsely, I will add for the record, that I had sexually harassed women at his resort while I was there. And at one point, maybe the most eerie moment, late at night, shortly after the profile was published, I was working on another story, and I got a G-chat message from a kind of notorious Republican opposition researcher who told me that someone was trying to recruit him and others to dig into my personal life and find skeletons in my closet that would finish me. That was the quote. Suffice it to say, I was fairly paranoid for a few days after that, looking over my shoulder. But anyway, that whole thing happened. What's interesting about that, and what I think is illustrative of a broader theme of this campaign, is that he never really dropped his feud with me. For the next, I guess, 2 years, he would continue to bring up that article in interviews with other journalists, whether it was on TV or other print journalists. They would tell me, oh my gosh, I couldn't get him to shut up about, you know, how wrong you were. At one point during a Republican debate, he actually called me out from the debate stage and said that I had gotten it wrong when I said that he would never run for president, which, to be fair, I did. And he continually brought this up. A few days before I can bring it up, he sent me an email a few days before the Republican convention where I won't read the whole thing, but it started off, "Dear McKay, you got it all wrong," which he wanted me to know, I guess.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. McKay Coppins is a senior writer for the BuzzFeed News Politics team. He's author of the 2015 book, The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a talk given last week by McKay Coppins, a senior writer for BuzzFeed. He also is a Mormon and a graduate of Brigham Young University. He spoke last week about his experiences covering Donald Trump's campaign this past year.
What's interesting, though, so I covered the Trump campaign for the last year, and what was interesting is as that campaign progressed, he got more and more upset with the press at large, right? It started with just a few particular reporters he hated, and then it grew into a daily refrain on the from the campaign trail stump. He would give these speeches, and there was a moment at every speech where he would have the entire crowd turn around to where the press was sitting. He had us confined to this metal pen at every event. There was like a metal pen that the journalists had to stay inside. And he would have everyone turn around and boo us and, you know, curse us out and tell us how terrible we were. And he would say, they're the most disgusting, worst people in the world, right? So reporters, understandably, were upset about that. They, I think, retaliated by, you know, being very aggressive in their coverage and saying that he was subverting the First Amendment, et cetera, et cetera. But what I noticed was that it was very often one of the loudest applause lines, one of the most successful applause lines that he had in his rallies. People loved that. And it was part of a broader theme of his campaign, which was he wasn't just running against the Democrats. He wasn't just running against liberal policies. He was running against the elites. He was running against the people in the political class, the media elite, Wall Street, whatever it was, the power structures in America and in the world that he considered to be corrupt. Now, he has a different reason for disliking those people than perhaps the average American voter does. He is somebody who has spent his life kind of consumed with a I don't know how exactly to say this, but he has a lot of resentment for people in power. Donald Trump, I later kind of went back and revisited this whole episode, and I talked to a lot of people in Donald Trump's life who have known him throughout his life, and he's somebody who, while he was born into a rich family, he was born, how many people here have been to New York City or know New York City well? It's a city that is made up of five boroughs, and Manhattan is the island. It's the one that everything famous happens at, right? It's where Wall Street is, where Times Square, where Broadway, you know, everything that you hear about New York City is in Manhattan. He was born in Queens, which is one of the outer boroughs, and he talked to me about this, and it turns out he tells in interviews, he talks about this all the time, that he remembers as a kid, he would stand on the edge of the East River, which separated his borough from Manhattan, and he would look across the river at Manhattan and kind of long to be a part of that world of elites, of titans of industry. He wanted to be part of that world. And once he took over his father's real estate empire, his first move was to expand it from the outer boroughs into kind of the glitzy real estate world in Manhattan. He really wanted to become known as a major player there. And when he got there, initially, investors, competitors, everyone laughed at him. They would trash him in the press. They would make fun of him. They would feed gossip about his various, you know, struggles and failures to the tabloids. They kind of delighted in mocking him, and that only drove him more to want to prove them wrong. And you can look throughout his entire career. He went to UPenn, to Wharton, the School of Finance there. And he transferred halfway through his college career. He was wanted to be part of that world. And all the kind of waspy Ivy League elites there kind of laughed at him and rolled their eyes at him. They thought he was kind of uncouth and this kid from the outer boroughs who had a thick accent. And that only drove him more to succeed. If you look at Donald Trump's entire life, he's basically been a man consumed with a desire to prove what he calls the haters wrong. And look where it's gotten him. I mean, look, he's the president-elect now. But what I think he caught on to, whether it was on purpose or accidental, was in his campaign, a lot of those same enemies that he has, the haters, the people in the business elite, the media elite, the political elite, those are the same people who a lot of Americans, especially in middle America, especially in the working and middle classes, feel victimized by, similar to Trump. While Trump's own relationship with those elites is somewhat different, a lot of people really latched on to his anti-establishment rhetoric and felt like he was channeling that in a way that none of the other Republican candidates were. So let's fast forward to where we are now. Donald Trump has shocked everyone, including his own campaign and himself, by winning the presidency. I can tell you that on election night, I was at his election party in Midtown Manhattan, and at the beginning of the night, the exit polls weren't looking good for him, and I was talking to a lot of his advisors, and they were all kind of like, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm going to have to be looking for a new job. You know, they all kind of felt like it was going to go against him, just like everyone else did, because they were all reading the same data. Obviously, that data ended up being wrong, and he won. But I think the question now is, where do we go from here? We are, I think, mired in a new kind of culture war, a new front in the culture wars, that's less about religion and social issues, though I think that those are parts of it, and more about the economy, more about cultural prestige. The cultural gap between especially coastal elites, but really the educated and affluent elites in this country, and the working and middle class voters who showed up to Donald Trump rallies, hundreds of whom I've interviewed over the past year, it's astonishing how big the gap is there. And I will cop to it as a reporter. The things that I thought that I thought would sink his campaign often were the same things that made those voters even more excited to vote for him. And that cycle repeated itself time and time again. The lesson that I took personally as a political reporter was that I need to question my own assumptions about, you know, what matters and how voters are responding to these things. But I think as a country, we need to grapple with this widening gap between cultural elites and the rest of Americans, and we need to figure out how to talk to each other. Often when I come to college campuses that are outside of the Northeast bubbles and coastal bubbles, I will say that one of the most important ways that gap can be bridged is for people like you to get more involved in the national conversation. I think that, you know, a lot of you here are students, you're college educated, you are on your way to becoming part of that cultural elite, but you have a perspective that's different from the, you know, 15 Ivy League undergrads who all interned at Newsweek with me, for example. You have different perspectives on religious life, you have different perspectives on the economy, you have different perspectives from the consensus inside a lot of the national newsrooms in this country. And so anyone considering a job in media or journalism, I would encourage it. But just more broadly, I would encourage you to reach out. As for my industry, I think that we need to spend a lot more time outside of those bubbles. I think we need to start hiring, let's just be clear, every single reporter on the Trump plane that I covered this campaign with was absolutely certain Trump was gonna lose. We were all looking at the same data. We all had the same assumptions about the dynamics of this race. I think we need to spend more time, my industry needs to hire more people who live outside those bubbles, who are talking to their neighbors, who are having the lived reality of a lot of the Trump voters, so that we know what's actually happening in this country. And the last thing I'll say before turning it over to questions is that, you know, so go back, there are probably some political history buffs/nerds in this room. Go back to Barry Goldwater's campaign. When he ran, he was considered a radical by a lot of the political establishment. He won the nomination, shocking the political world, and his victory ended up leading to a real realignment in the political landscape in this country. That was when the southern states flipped from being reliable Democratic voters to Republican voters. Liberals, who were actually a major faction in the Republican Party up until then, were eventually chased out of the party and became Democrats. There was a real realignment that happened as the Republican Party was taken over by conservatives. I think we could be seeing in the coming years a similar realignment take place here. Donald Trump, and I don't know how it'll shape up, I'm not saying it'll happen the same way, but Donald Trump represents a new brand of politics. He is not a traditional conservative Republican. His rhetoric about trade, for example, is not conservative by any modern definition. His rhetoric about entitlement reform and even the size and scope of government. He's not a Jeffersonian small government conservative. He will say himself, he is a nationalist, he's a populist, and he doesn't have a lot of reverence for the, you know, traditional conservatism that's kind of fueled the Republican Party for the last half century. So where do legitimate, genuine conservatives go? I don't know the answer, but I think that the next several years we could be seeing that realignment take place. And I think that people in this part of the country especially, who clearly are unhappy, as we saw just in this last election in this state, unhappy with the traditional Republican, Democrat two-party system that we have here, have a big role to play in that conversation. And I guess my pitch to you is to make your voices as loud as possible. The stories that I wrote about Utah this cycle were some of the most interesting that I wrote, some of the stories that I most enjoyed writing, also some of the stories that got the most attention. Frankly, what's happening in this state and in the Mountain West area in general is grabbing the attention of the rest of the country. And it'll be interesting to see where, especially younger voters here, where you guys go from here. But I encourage you to be as involved as possible. And now I'll take any questions that you have.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. Coming up after the break, McKay Coppins, the senior writer for BuzzFeed, takes some questions from University of Utah students about his thoughts on Donald Trump's election and what it means to be a political reporter covering the new president-elect. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Last week, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted McKay Coppins, a senior writer for BuzzFeed, the online news website. Coppins is a BYU graduate and also a Mormon. He was one of the political reporters who began covering Donald Trump's campaign for the White House early on. In 2014, he wrote a now famous article titled 36 Hours on the Fake Campaign Trail with Donald Trump, an article that upset Donald Trump, to say the least. He spoke last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and he answered questions from students.
Thank you. My name's Nick. I'm a senior here, political science, and I'm also an Air Force veteran. And I served in the intelligence community for about 7 years, so I kind of worked at some point with General Flynn and kind of saw his demise as the director of the DIA. For, you know, pretty valid reasons. So my question kind of revolves around Trump and then his, you know, kind of advisors or his cabinet, in that we see a lot about Trump, you know, being kind of not level-headed and, you know, giving him the button, so to speak, to launch a nuclear arsenal and things like that. In my opinion, someone like Flynn is actually more dangerous in that regard and less level-headed. So question being, in your opinion and from your perspective, Trump and his advisors, is there some sort of reciprocity there, or is it more them leading him and him being kind of the mouthpiece, so to speak?
That's a good question. I don't know how his cabinet will shape up. He's made very few appointments so far, though Flynn obviously is one of them. Here's what I'll say. His inner circle right now, there are two very distinct factions. His White House chief of staff, the incoming chief of staff, is Reince Priebus, who's the head of the RNC, very much a mainstream Republican. He's the guy who has ties to people like Mitt Romney, to a lot of the Republicans in Washington and Congress. He and people like him in Trump's inner circle are very strongly encouraging Trump to be careful and deliberate about the people that he adds to his cabinet and to the appointments that he makes. They feel like, you know, if you injected them with truth serum, I think they would admit that Donald Trump has not thought through a lot of the issues that a president will face. And so the people that he ends up appointing to his cabinet and to his administration are going to have a much larger role in shaping public policy and foreign policy than is probably true with other presidents. So those are the people driving, and Mike Pence, by the way, is part of that faction, the kind of more mainstream Republican faction. They're the ones driving, for example, the talk of Mitt Romney for Secretary of State. They're trying to get Trump to meet with who they consider the best and brightest of the Republican Party, the people who are most experienced, have the deepest knowledge, and trying to get him to make some of those picks. The other faction in the Republican, or in Trump's inner circle, is people like Steve Bannon, who is the head of Breitbart until he joined the campaign. This is a much more unorthodox, I will say kindly, an unorthodox group of people. These are not people who are inclined to make Mitt Romney Secretary of State or give him any kind of job. They were the ones who kind of drove this message throughout the campaign of draining the swamp. That was part of, you know, Trump's rhetoric of really clearing out Washington of everyone who has contributed to the corruption and the kind of gridlock there, and bringing in all outsiders. I don't know which faction will win or will win out. Like I said, we haven't seen very many of those appointments yet. My guess is probably both sides will have some wins, but I don't think this is a partisan statement to say, but I do think that Donald Trump could really use some experienced people, even if they are imperfect, you know, political operators, even if they are kind of creatures of DC. I think Donald Trump is so inexperienced. We've never had a president with less political experience. He obviously has a lot of business experience. I think he could use some people with a lot more political experience. Flynn, I will say, has plenty of experience, but he is a bomb thrower. He was out on the campaign trail with Donald Trump for months, saying some of the most outrageous things at those rallies, and that's saying a lot. So I will obviously look at, like any patriotic American, I'm rooting for the president to behave in a way that will benefit the country, but I don't know how that's going to shape up. But that's the dynamic, the best I can tell.
My name is Derek. I'm a political science graduate. So, to me, I don't think Trump won. I think Hillary lost, in a sense that against any traditional candidate like President Obama, I think Donald Trump never would have had a chance to win. But with everything going around Hillary, that I think that's what led to his rise. And if the Democratic Party would have chosen another candidate, a lot of students on campus actually believe Bernie Sanders would have had a better chance than Hillary did. But I personally believe that that is why he was elected. What's your opinion? If the Democratic Party, did they really just want Hillary to become president so bad that they didn't care about finding a better candidate, or your opinion on the matter?
Yeah, I think that in looking back on this election cycle, the Democratic Party's decision to essentially clear the field and make way for Hillary Clinton will be seen as one of the stupider decisions made by a major political party in this country. You know, look, Hillary Clinton had a lot going for her. She had, you know, a lot of experience, a lot of foreign policy experience. She also, as it turned out, was basically tailor-made to be a target for Donald Trump's message, right? Donald Trump was leading a populist revolt in this country, and Hillary Clinton was essentially the embodiment of what he was campaigning against. I'm not sure, though. I mean, look, you can never run these counterfactuals. I don't know. Maybe Joe Biden, if he had run, would have done better against Donald Trump. Maybe Bernie Sanders would have. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the Democratic Party is now, I think, in as much disarray and looking at the next 4 years, facing as much chaos as the Republican Party has had in the past 4 years. They're going to have to make a lot of decisions about what they stand for and who they are. One thing I will say is that the elite consensus coming out of a presidential election is almost always wrong. Think about 2012 with Mitt Romney losing. The RNC did this autopsy report where they had the best and brightest minds come together and you know, basically write a roadmap for winning in 2016, and it included reaching out to Latinos, softening their position on immigration, doing more to reach out to women. Basically, you go through this list, and Donald Trump did the opposite of every single thing the RNC suggested, and then, of course, he won. So I would be wary of making any definitive statements right now about where the Democratic Party is headed, except that I think we can pretty confidently predict that there's a lot of chaos and civil war coming over the next 4 years. I refuse to answer any questions. This is my former mission president.
Anyway, thanks for coming. It's great having you, such an honored guest here. I graduated from the U 40 years ago, and I'm still standing, but... The most hopeful thing I heard from Donald Trump was in his Gettysburg talk on his 20 points of what he'd do. Number one, that he would change term limits, because there's so many things that are wrong in Washington in general, I think, without that, we never hear about, I'll just throw out one, and I want your opinion of why this has never come up in my long years of existence. A guy that does my taxes just retired. He does John Huntsman's taxes, and he's gone to the convention where they do, they figure out what the real national debt is, and it's not $19 trillion. If you add the off-balance sheet debt, which is the obligation to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, which are way bigger than Social Security, it's somewhere between $63 and $200 trillion. Why does this never come up in any political, is it just a death knell for a candidate, or does anybody in Washington even understand that particular factoid?
You hit on, first of all, I think the last thing you said probably hit on it, that a lot of, and I will speak more broadly here, a lot of the people, a shocking number of the people you talk to in Washington, people, including policy wonks on Capitol Hill, when you wade into kind of budgetary matters and national debt matters, it becomes a little hazy for everyone. I will say, though, that what are the political realities of this are I think what prevent a real conversation about the national debt and the deficit. What does that mean, right? What are the policy implications of that? It means, if you're treating this realistically, that you're going to start calling for massive if not cuts, at least reforms and basically reorganizing everything that's happening in our government, and nobody wants to talk about that in an interview or on the stump, right? That's not popular. One thing that I'm concerned about coming out of Donald Trump's campaign is that when, you know, Trump, I remember from the very first speech that I covered from Trump back in 2014, he made fun of Paul Ryan and the Republicans who say that they want to reform entitlement programs to make them more sustainable long term. And he said, I'm just going to make our country so rich that we can afford everything. And he has changed his tone a little bit. But the reality is, this country, whether you're Republican, Democrat, whatever you think of conservative policies, this country needs in its political conversation a party that's willing to say the unpopular things and the unpopular realities when it comes to fiscal policy. And the Republican Party has been essentially that party. They have not been willing to go as far, I think, as a lot of people would like. But they were at least the ones who say, look, they'll tell a wage earner who's 30 years old, 25 years old, that the reality is you're going to have to wait till you're 73 or 75 to retire, right? That's not something that most Democrats are willing to say. Republicans are willing to say it. Trump is not willing to say any of that. His whole message, he doesn't care about shrinking the size of government, at least, you know, hasn't run on it very much. And he said that his campaign is about economic populism. Well, that's great, but I still think we need a voice in this country making that case. And I'm worried that the more that the Republican Party is reshaped to in the image of Donald Trump, the fewer voices we'll have like that in that conversation. So that is one concern I have. That doesn't directly answer your question, but that's that's it. That's as close as I'll get.
Hi, my name is Brad. I'm a political science student here at the university. As a close observer to the Donald Trump campaign, and we're talking about his cabinet appointees and everything, from what you see, does he even listen to advisors? I mean, is he, as we knew with his campaign, advisors were telling him, don't do this, and he'd do it, and he'd do it. Does he listen to advisors? Will his cabinet actually, feel, have a say in things? Or is he just going to have his own idea and go with it anyways?
I was talking about, we had a lunch before this, and I was telling them that Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager, his third campaign manager, the last one, said that the way that she dealt with this issue was that she treated it kind of like she does with her little children, where she'll say, instead of eating six brownies today, how about you just eat one brownie? That was kind of the approach she took with Donald Trump, and would say, instead of tweeting 17 angry things about, you know, the media or SNL or whatever, why don't you just tweet one and then stop, you know? There are people, look, one thing I will say to Trump's credit is that those advisors who kept telling him to change his message and change his approach, et cetera, ended up being wrong, right? Or at least it didn't matter. He ended up winning anyway. So this is what I think about Donald Trump. He is a person who has better media instincts, better entertainment instincts, better messaging instincts than I think anyone we've seen in politics in a long time. But when it comes, and so when somebody is trying to tell him how to do that part of the job, he isn't inclined to listen to them. That said, when it comes to how to run the Department of Health and Human Services, that's maybe not so much in his wheelhouse and also not as interesting to him. And I think that the person he appoints in his cabinet to run that part of it will have a lot more power. In fact, we've already seen reports that, contrary to tradition, he's making appointment once his decision, the way their transition team is running it, is once they make the top level appointments, they're telling those people to just staff their departments. Like, you go out and find people and hire them. Traditionally, the president-elect will be a little bit more involved in those sub-cabinet appointments, but he's kind of outsourcing that part of it. So that, to me, suggests that he is willing to, if not necessarily let them tell him what to do, he's at least willing to kind of let them do their thing while he focuses on the things that he finds most interesting and stimulating. Which, realistically, I mean, there's a lot of fun to be had, you know, talking about Donald Trump, who does actually, I think, have a relatively short attention span. But the reality is the federal government is so massive that large portions of it do kind of run themselves. And so I think that, you know, I don't want to say, you know, no one should panic, because maybe we should panic a little bit. But the reality is, I think that, you know, the republic will stand. A lot of the federal government will continue to go about its, continue to do what it's been doing for a long time. And we'll just have to see how the president does his part of the job. Just let you decide.
So I am not a political science student. I'm actually a journalism student. So what things, following the crazy data that happened in this election, what things would you suggest that as media we should be looking at so that the skewage of opinion from the data doesn't happen again in the future? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I would just say only the flash polls on the Drudge Report. That's the only thing we should pay attention to. No. So I was just saying this to someone else, that I feel a little conflicted about this, because I covered the Romney campaign, and I remember at the end of that campaign, you know, the polls showed him losing, but I remember that he would go into places like suburban Philadelphia in the final days of the campaign, and 20 or 30,000 people would show up. And I remember, as a reporter covering my first campaign, being like, man, the momentum on the ground is totally going toward Romney, and like, forget the polls, he's probably going to win, right? That's how kind of a lot of reporters were thinking. At the time, we were going off gut, right? And we were wrong. The polls ended up being right in that election. And so the lesson I took from that was, you know, whatever my gut is telling me, I need to focus on the data. And then, of course, that kind of, I was wrong twice. But I don't think we should abandon data. I think that we need to, I mean, the reality is that's still the best way to judge where, you know, how a campaign is going. I also will say, as a political journalist, forecasting the results of an election is not the most important thing that I do. It's not even in the top five most important things that I do. I think there is a natural human impulse to ask, you know, who's going to win. I can't tell you how many people, friends, family members, the first thing they say when they see me off the campaign trail, so who's going to win? Who do you think is going to win? I understand that. But the reality is, you know, what the ideal function of the political press is to, you know, cover the candidate, to cover the, you know, dissect the candidate's policy messages, hold them to account when they're spinning or lying, provide a chronicle of their campaign, of, you know, profile people in power. That those are the things that we should be doing. I obviously we still need good data, but I think that that's more a question that pollsters and data experts need to work out. The one thing I will say is, I guess, just take data, you know, with a grain of salt, maybe, when you're you never be 100% confident in an election outcome. But yeah, I think that the reality is, for the media, we need to get back to the core fundamentals of what role we play in these campaigns. And it's not to predict who's going to win. It's to hold the candidates to account.
Hi, I'm a business student. But throughout Donald Trump's campaign, he made a lot of outrageous comments that really insulted probably half the population. Do you think that was more of a publicity stunt, or do you think that was reflective of what he truly feels?
Well, it depends on which ones. I think Donald Trump has a extreme desire and a unique instinct for entertaining people. And I can tell you definitively, because he said this to me and his campaign staffers have said this to me, that his favorite thing about running for president, about being in the political sphere, is standing at a podium in front of thousands of people and talking to them. That's what he likes doing, because he is better than any politician I've seen in a long time. Barack Obama 2008 might be in this league, but at just whipping his crowds up into a frenzy, getting them so excited. That's what he loves to do. And he loves making them laugh, and he loves making them react viscerally and emotionally. And that's why in a lot of cases over the last year and a half, the most outrageous things he would say, it was to get a reaction out of the crowd. Did he necessarily believe them 100%? I think he believed in them in some general sense. But, you know, for example, the chance of lock her up, right? Locking up Hillary Clinton. You say, you know, the last couple weeks of the campaign, he was going around promising that he was going to put Hillary Clinton in jail if he became president. Today we got word from Kellyanne Conway, his former campaign manager, that he's not interested in doing that now. Did he know when he was saying that he had no intention of following through? I don't know. He probably wasn't thinking it through that much. He was probably just trying to get a reaction out of his crowd. But what I'm not willing to say is that this was all just politics and for show, and that deep down he's actually a really sensitive, totally different guy. I think that we got a pretty good sense of who Donald Trump is on the campaign trail. It might be a little less high octane in real life, but I think that that is basically who he is. So we should calibrate our expectations accordingly.
Hi, my name is Kevin. Thank you for being here. Just a short question. In the time of now, as we are looking at post-truth being the word of the year, and also fake news and Facebook and all that, how do you think is the future going to be with the relationship of the press to the public and also to the president?
It's a great question. You mentioned fake news. One, here, let me just give you one little startling finding that we had at BuzzFeed. We did after the election, we found the top 20 stories that got the most engagement on Facebook in the last, I think, 10 days of the election. So the 20 articles that got the most shares, likes, comments, that got the most engagement on Facebook. 17... No, all articles. Not BuzzFeed articles. All articles. The top 20 fake news stories that were completely false, not just misleading, not just with a partisan slant, the top 20 fake stories outperformed the top 20 real stories on Facebook. That means on Facebook, more people were interacting with and engaging with fake news in the last 10 days of the election than real news. That should scare us enough. As a side note, of those top 20 fake stories, 17 of them were pro-Trump stories or anti-Clinton stories. I think Trump certainly benefited from this. I'm not willing to say, though, that if fake news had been eliminated from this campaign, Hillary Clinton would win the election. I don't think any one factor led to Trump's victory. But I do think that's going to be a major problem that we have to confront going forward. I mean, look, up until the internet, there were very firm gatekeepers in the media, right? The only ways that you really could transmit information and news was by owning a printing press or having access to the broadcast airwaves. That's obviously not true anymore, and there's no regulatory body that regulates the internet. I don't think there should be, by the way. But I do think that these platforms like Facebook and Twitter, the platforms that have that are, you know, where so many people are now getting their news, need to take some responsibility. Now, I'm a little wary. I'm somewhat libertarian when it comes to information. I think that, you know, we shouldn't be censoring anyone. But Facebook is a private platform. They can decide what's allowed to be on their platform. And I think Facebook, especially, needs to take responsibility and decide whether they want these, you know, propaganda arms that are not just, again, these aren't just partisan news sites. I think partisan opinion and spin should be allowed, but just outright fake news factories, I think, should probably be banned from these platforms. But that the only way that's going to happen is if these platforms take responsibility. In the meantime, in my profession, in the mainstream media, we need to try to win back readers' credibility. And we're never going to be able to fight that fake news unless we have credibility with our readers. So that's on us, too.
Okay,
I don't know how much... Yeah, how much,
yeah, we have time for one more question here, so... Who wants it?
No. I'd just like to ask about the Mike Pence role in this situation. And I think he'll be one of the most visible beefs we've probably had in years, you know, and stand by my man kind of thing. And, you know, with the Hamilton episode just a few days ago, you know, that he's going to have
Hamilton Gate.
Yeah, he's going to really have to be some pretty thick-skinned, and he's going to have to take a lot of this flack. How do you think Mike Pence will play through this, being he's on the transition team and all this that, you know?
Did anyone see Saturday Night Live, this most recent, the opening sketch at the end of it? You know, Trump is panicking about all these things now he has to do now that he's president. At the end, he grabs Mike Pence and says, "By the way, you're going to do everything right." And Mike Pence says, "Yeah, don't worry." I think Mike Pence is going to play a big role. I think, there was a report, I guess it was in the New York Times Magazine over the summer, about somebody in Trump's camp, it might have been one of Trump's sons, approached John Kasich about potentially being the running mate. And when he talked to Kasich, he said, you know, "How would you like to be the most powerful vice president in American history?" And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" Trump's son said, "You could be, you'll be in charge of foreign policy and domestic policy." And he said, "Well, what is Trump going to be in charge of?" And the response was, "Oh, he'll be in charge of making America great again." Now, who knows if that's exactly how that conversation went. But I do think Mike Pence is going to play a big role here. I also know that a lot of Republican voters voted for Trump holding their nose in hopes that Mike Pence would actually be the one kind of running the show. What I will say is that, as far as I know from the people I talk to in the Trump camp, he doesn't have the same kind of close camaraderie with Trump that some of the other aides do. That said, I know that Trump respects him a lot, and, you know, Pence is somebody who has a lot of experience in politics. So I think he will have Trump's ear. I have to say, it's a thankless job being the one to, you know, constantly have to, you know, navigate Trump's various moods. But I think that if, you know, those of us hoping for some general semblance of normalcy in the next 4 years should be rooting for Pence to do that. Anyway, thank you, guys.
All right, thank you. Help me thank McKay Coppins.
McKay Coppins is a senior writer for BuzzFeed, the online news website. He spoke last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Coppins is also a Mormon and a graduate from BYU, and he spoke about his experiences covering Donald Trump's campaign. If you'd like to hear this full talk again, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.